This episode is brought to you by New Internationalist's very own Ethical Shop, which sells a wide range of ethical and fair trade goods. With the world in a tailspin, fairness isn't a given, but the power to get at least some of the way there is in our hands. Together, our actions can have a positive impact on real people's lives. Fairer pay, fairer treatment, fairer futures. That's fair trade. Learn more and shop the range of products at ethicalshop.org. Listeners to this show can also get 10% off their online order using the discount code ETHICAL. More details via the links in our show notes. Welcome to The World Unspun. I'm your host, Maxine Betteridge-Mose. We are at a critical crossroads. A global wave of far-right authoritarianism is threatening human rights, climate action, and democracy, and steering the world towards disaster. From Donald Trump in the White House to Javier Milei in Argentina, ideologies that were once confined to the fringes are now dictating the agenda from inside the halls of power. In September, we gathered some of the contributors to our latest magazine on the rise of the global far right for a special Ask Us Anything event with our readers. Today's episode is an edited version of that discussion, in which you'll hear from American labor reporter Kim Kelly.
Things in the States are really dark right now, but there's so many ways that you can make the world a little bit better, even if it's just your block, just your neighborhood.
Josefina Salomon, a Buenos Aires-based reporter.
No one can make it alone, so we all have to go and protest when the government wants to cut funding for public hospitals. It is our collective responsibility to go out and go against that.
Balázs Turkson, who is a longtime member of the Hungarian left-wing SIKRA movement.
The left for a long time refused to participate in institutional politics, but unfortunately that's where the power is. And sometimes if you want to be in power, you have to accept that.
A New Internationalist co-editor, Beth Riley.
I think in left movements, we've sort of lost a lot of our tradition of anti-fascist organizing, of internationalism as well, that were really strong in our movements in the last century.
Stay tuned for more. And if you like what you hear, please consider subscribing to New Internationalist. You'll get full access to our latest issue on the global far right, alongside our full digital archive dating back to 1973. Learn more via the links in our show notes.
So Beth, I just wanted to start with you. Can you explain how we defined the far right in the issue of the magazine, but also what some of the definitions people should be aware of?
Broadly speaking, you know, there are commonalities and there are threads that we can use today to define them. So how we did this in the magazine is authoritarianism, nationalism, and the rejection of minority rights. When it comes to authoritarianism, there are kind of elements of the far right that kind of advocate for a full takeover of the state and dictatorship, whereas there are others who kind of operate working within the democratic system and kind of say on the face of things they agree with democracy, but oppose the rule of law, separation of powers, independent media. When it comes to nationalism, this sort of hyper-nationalism, ethno-nationalism, like we see in Israel today or in Modi's India with Hindutva, which is a Hindu supremacist nationalism, and the rejection of minority rights, so women's rights, migrant rights, the rights of queer communities. And then there are kind of new ideological currents as well that we see with the new far right today, such as the kind of great replacement theory. So this is a kind of racist conspiracy theory that people sort of believe that migrants are replacing native populations. And this then ties into another kind of conspiracy theory, this idea of gender ideology, the natural family, which is they define as a nuclear biological family, and traditional values being under threat from gains in gender equality, LGBTQI plus rights, and that this is driving the breakdown of our societies.
Thanks, Beth. Yeah, and I'd be interested to hear what everyone else thinks as we go on as well. But I had a question that I kind of wanted to ask a few of you, which was about why you think far right parties, like political parties, have been on the rise around the world. And Balázs, I was wondering if I could come to you first on that one.
Yeah, it's It's a bit difficult to answer right now in Hungary because we are in a really different political discourse. I think Orban was one of the, you know, leading figures of this new right movement globally, one of them. And he has sort of lost his momentum right now. So he's already behind when others are rising up. I would say my short answer is that people are, fed up with the precarious lives that they are living under neoliberalism and that they are associating with, you know, the third way and, you know, quote unquote, leftist liberal movements. And I think that far right parties are, very deft at, at least discursively grab that political momentum and use that frustration in their favor.
Yeah, thank you. And actually, I was wondering, Josefina, I know Balázs just mentioned about the kind of slightly like changing political situation in Hungary, but Javier Milei has also kind of maybe had a bit of a dent in popularity. And I was wondering kind of what you thought about that and whether you see any hope there. And then, Kim, it would be interesting to hear your perspective from the US as well.
I think the interesting thing that we're seeing in Latin America, when we ask ourselves the question of why do people support these far-right movements, we're really seeing populations really swing between parties. So we see it in Argentina. We're seeing it at the moment. So Milei won with quite a decent amount of support, and now that support is swinging. We saw it in Brazil. So they had Bolsonaro, a really far-right politician, and then Lula, the complete opposite, came after him. And we're seeing that in many countries. So in a way, lots of the experts that I've spoken to have told me this is about people trying to find solutions and in a way a bit of desperate solutions to some of the problems they're facing. And most of those issues are to do with the economics, right? To trying to make it to the end of the month. Then you've got this far-right politicians offering magical solutions that then clearly don't work. And then people kind of support them at first, and then they realize those solutions. In many of our, in Latin America, a lot of those solutions have to do with neoliberal economic policies supported by economic interests and global institutions like the International Monetary Fund. So these aren't just national ideas. And then when they don't work, then people kind of stop supporting them and go back to other parties that were in power before.
Yeah, thanks, Josefina. Kim, what's your kind of perspective in the US and with Trump coming back and everything that's been happening there in politics?
Like the other two panelists mentioned, so much of it comes down to the economy, to capitalism, to the fact that people are struggling under these systems that are built to oppress them, to exploit their labor, to exploit and extract every piece of their being. There are so many people who are exploited or hunted down or dehumanized just a little extra because of who they are, where they come from, who they love, their identity, all of this. And in the States, we also have something that I don't know if it gets mentioned as much in sort of these global conversations about the rise of the far right. Religion, specifically extremist Christian fundamentalist, like Christo-fascist ideology, is deeply embedded in the current far-right movement to the point where, like, we are on our way to becoming a theocratic nation, even more so than we are already. It's all tied together with the fact, with all these different factors, whether it's the down spiral in American manufacturing and the jobs that came with that, these neoliberal policies, the incredible weakness of our so-called opposition party, which is, in fact, like the Democratic Party is a center-right party, right? The Republicans are a far-right party. Neither of those are looking out for the people. Corporate interests and our many evil billionaires really control so much of the political landscape that regular people just feel hopeless. And so when you have these demagogues, these authoritarians, these pseudo-populists, that try and say that all of your problems are based on someone else. It's the queer people, it's the trans people, it's immigrants, it's Black folks, it's anybody but you is where the problem is. And we're gonna we're going to hurt them. We're going to fix everything. We're going to take care of you as long as you're, you know, a white guy who prays more times a day than I have since I was like 12. There's all these different currents, and we're also an incredibly violent nation. And all of this kind of comes together into this really gnarly primordial soup that obviously the rise of Trump and then the rebound of Trump has not helped any of that, because so much of that far right rhetoric has been mainstreamed and become government policy in a way that I think people didn't necessarily expect when he first appeared, God, almost 10 years ago. Really just kind of all of these different factors being exacerbated by the people in power and exacerbated by the fact that so many people here are struggling and suffering. We have no safety net. We have nothing to save us. If you fall into poverty, if you fall into homelessness, no one's going to be there to help you up. So why not blame somebody else for your problems? Because getting rid of this entire exploitative system, the people in power don't want that to happen. So got to blame somebody else.
And this is one of the questions that came in via Instagram, actually. I wondered what you all thought about how we can counter that kind of very simplistic messaging that really seems to like get through to people.
This is a place where I think labor organizing can be incredibly beneficial, because if you think about it, there are very few instances in your life where you're around a bunch of different people. You haven't chosen me in their company. You're all there for a common goal. You all have a common enemy, your boss. That's what your workplace is. You don't pick your coworkers, but you can figure out what your common ground is. You can find your common issues. You can organize against your boss. It's going to a union meeting or getting involved in a union and organizing is a great way to interact with people that maybe think differently from you, have different experiences, come from someone different, but you have that common ground. And I've seen it firsthand. Like, this is labor organizing is one of the things that makes me really hopeful about combating this, especially when unions and organizers put that effort into really emphasizing that this is not a black versus white, immigrant versus born here. Like, this is all artificial division to distract you from the fact that you're getting screwed by this boss, by this CEO, by this industry. It's like you said, the cartoon about the cookies, like, that is incredibly real. And that's why we've seen some of the more, I think, encouraging action taking against the far right, especially in terms of the immigration raids we're dealing with, are coming from the labor world, because you can't, that's where you have to listen to people and understand that you are on the same team. And that's very difficult to do in basically any other context in this country, at least.
Here in Argentina, we are very fortunate that we have a very strong social movements, from trade unions to even football clubs to just everyone. It's a very common thing to be organized around a cause that affects you, because everyone is affected by a cause, right? And because of our recent history, dictatorships that we have suffered, etc. And the interesting thing was that, yeah, the far right is extremely smart in having these symbols. So Javier Milei won the presidency practically coming from nowhere with this image of a chainsaw. He wanted to destroy the state. In Argentina, the state is very important. So here we have public health, public education, free university education, free science research. And we're very proud of that. That really is what is. Many people would agree, I think, that that's one of the things that makes Argentina what it is. Then this president comes in and says, I'm going to destroy all of it, all of this, and with this message of everybody for themselves. So this message that I think is very popular around the world now, that is, if you want to be rich, you can work a lot and then you'll be rich. You know, if you want to be fine, just work or just drive. Drive an Uber or do deliveries. And then if you work hard enough, you're going to make it. This false narrative that I think a lot of people are buying into, which we know isn't really the case, right? There's so many other factors around whether somebody can make it to the end of the month or not. And very interestingly, there is a really famous TV show called The Eternaut. I don't know if people will be familiar with it. The message is a sci-fi kind of end of the world, but the message of it is, no one can make it alone. And people really took to that and said, okay, that's our message. And it's kind of the headline that Bethany and I put to our story. But The message is no one can make it alone. So we all have to go and protest when the government wants to cut funding for public hospitals or for pensioners or for the science research or for education or for whatever it is. It is our collective responsibility to go out and go against that.
Thanks. And Balázs, did you want to come in on this one?
Yeah, just to give a Hungarian example, I think 19, when a law that was popularized as the slave law was passed by the Fidesz-dominated parliament, which damaged labor rights in insane ways in terms of overtime, overtime payment, unions, etc. And there was mass organization by the people who were targeted negatively by this law. And it was a huge momentum. And at the same time, Fidesz banned another law, basically exiling one of our biggest liberal universities in Hungary, Central European University, because it had a course on gender. And what oppositional leaders did at the time was that they completely forgot about like labor rights and liberal organization, and jumped right into that issue, which is, you know, it's important, but it doesn't resonate with masses of the people. And I think the two should happen, you know, connected. I think, you know, that should be the focus of political messaging, like issues that really resonate with the everyday lives of people.
Yeah, thanks, Balázs. And we actually had a question in the chat from Ben about what other things that we can do on the left. So he says, how have the far right managed to create coalitions across such diverse contexts? And it seems very strange to me that they can be racial / national supremacists from different countries. And why is the left not able to do the same? Or are they, like, what kind of examples have you seen of this kind of coalition building?
I do think that a lot of the far right movements are animated by very basic kind of agreements. Like, if you can disagree on policy or on specific laws or specific points of ideology with someone, but if you're both like, I'm cool with racism, or I'm cool with hating trans people and queer people and women, or white supremacy, ultimate goal, we want to do Christo-fascism however we get there, I think it's clearly, like, it's a little easier to organize around, like, screw those people, we want to take care of our people. Versus, like, on the left, we have so many different ideas and so many different ideologies and so many different disagreements and so many different priorities, because there's a lot going on. And I don't know if the answer is for every left-leaning person to coalesce around one thing, whether it's, you know, like a living wage or basic human rights for all people that live here or amnesty for immigrants. That would be nice, but I feel like there's just I don't know why we're so bad at it, but I think it's because there's such a diversity of ideas and sort of like ideologies on the left that it can be hard to agree even just at your local anarchist collective meeting, right? Like, that could be a 5-hour meeting deciding on what you're doing that Sunday. The far right doesn't have that problem because they don't care as much. And I think the far right is also sort of more engineered towards accepting, like, a hierarchical structure. Like, they kind of look for leaders, for strongmen, for martyrs. Because there is, at least in the States, there's still that Christo-fascist sort of thing operating, where it's like very male supremacist, white male supremacist, in a way that, again, you're not seeing on the left, at least in the States.
Yeah, I think we can all relate, like, anyone who's been involved in progressive, like, left-wing organizing, of spending way too long on trying to, you know, have consensus on a decision, and thinking in that moment, maybe we should have a leader, like, maybe we should be top down. But no. Yeah, so it is really interesting that there are even movements that seem fundamentally opposed to one another will unite over racism. And this is something I see in Spain too. I'm based in Barcelona. In Spain, there's the far-right Vox party. And in Catalonia, there's a specific far-right Catalan supremacist party that want to have an independent state, an independent country of Catalonia, which Vox are against. And that's actually how they became so popular, you know, a few years ago. But they are collaborating with one another because they share a hatred of Muslims, and they're both very Islamophobic. So, yeah, it's the kind of united power of racism and overcoming differences because they have a stronger enemy, which I just find quite disturbing. But yeah, I think in left movements we've sort of lost a lot of our tradition of anti-fascist organizing, of internationalism as well, that were really strong in our movements in the last century, and that's something that we need to kind of get back again. And there are some amazing efforts at the moment to unite struggles across borders. I think, you know, when we see movements that are coming up, all these, like, a huge upswell of solidarity in support of Palestine, against the genocide, these are all things that we can kind of like mobilize from as well. But yeah, it's something I think maybe we need to look back at past movements to inform our movements today.
So we had another question about political parties. Actually, a couple of questions. So the first one was about what kind of responses you think our political parties should be exercising against the far right, and how the political left can tackle the vague populist and deep rhetorics of the far right. And then Doug asks a kind of specific question about the US around the Democratic Party, and where they have kind of failed in recent years. And I wonder if those two are kind of slightly connected.
I don't want to take up too much time, but I got a lot of thoughts about this, about the Democratic Party. They're useless, is the thing. They're supposed to be our opposition party, our left party, our liberal party. They're a corporate party. They're a corporate party that have been holding on to power for so long and are so just sort of beholden to the corporate donors and policies that prop up corporate interests, that any time there is a younger or more progressive candidate that breaks through and does get some support, they will go above and beyond to kneecap them, like chase them out of power, smear them, red bait them. I mean, God, look what they've done to Ilhan Omar. Like, the amount of racism and Islamophobia that poor woman has had to deal with. Or Rashida Tlaib, one of our only good legislators. She's Palestinian, and the amount of hatred and vitriol she's had to deal with just for acknowledging the humanity of her own people and of people in Palestine to begin with. Like, it's unfortunate. We don't have a left party that has any sort of recognition or power. We don't have really powerful left figures in this country, because that goes against everything that the parties in power support and represent. It's really getting to like kind of a gnarly place, though, because the Democrats, the Democratic Party, their approval ratings, they're in the toilet. And that's not really great for normal people, because we have a big midterm election coming up where we're supposed to elect a whole bunch of new legislators. And if regular people are angry at the Democrats for not delivering anything on wages, on healthcare, on basic human needs, let alone any of their highfalutin rhetoric around saving democracy and human rights, but they don't do anything. And people are like, well, I'm going to vote for this person who doesn't do anything and also kind of talks down to me, doesn't seem to understand where I'm coming from, doesn't seem to get how life is so hard for me right now, a regular working class person. And then you have a Republican candidate who is just as bad, probably almost certainly much worse, but pretends to care, pretends to tell people, oh, I care about you, your struggle as, you know, a former manufacturing worker or a coal miner or, you know, any other insert classic white guy job here. Like, it's the immigrants who are causing problems. It's queer people causing problems. Like, it's, the choices are really stark here. And one last thing that I will mention in terms of the Democratic Party specifically, and specifically in this moment, the fact that they are so, like, the party leadership and so many of the highest profile and most powerful members in government, they just refuse to do anything with their power to stop the genocide in Gaza. They are they close their ranks and actively punish anybody who even mentions perhaps we should cut some aid to Israel. Perhaps we should support the Palestinians. Perhaps we should do something. And that is very much out of step with normal people, with the populace in this country, because we have eyes, we can see what's happening. So I think they're just going to keep falling in relevance unless they do an extreme about face, completely reform the whole party, bring in an entirely new crop of leadership. But they're not going to do that because they're all a billion years old. They all make way too much money and they don't care about regular working class people. And we can tell. That's the problem. We can tell they don't care about us.
Thank you. Yeah, Balazs.
I've been following American politics a bit more closely lately. And I feel like I have some hope. I feel like we might be witnessing a sort of populist moment 2.0 with like people like Zoran Mamdani or Katie Wilson in Seattle, Omar Fateh, I think, in Minneapolis, and this new guy, Graham Platner, in Maine. One thing about them is that they're sort of politically brave in that they dare to say certain things, like they dare to say capitalism, the word capitalism, or they dare to say genocide and you know, stuff like that. So a sort of political bravery, I think, characterizes them. But an other thing I think is important when it comes to these figures is that they also sort of understand political realism. And what I mean by that is that I think part of the reason the left, you know, besides all the structural reasons, but part of it has been that we have for a long time refused to participate in institutional politics. Sometimes we are just too smart for our own good. We don't believe in, you know, representation in like bourgeois democracies and stuff like that. But unfortunately, that's where the power is. And sometimes if you want to be in power, you have to accept that, you know, power exists. You know, that was one thing that the political movement, the green left political movement that I'm involved in, realized in Hungary, is that sometimes you just have to come out of your leftist pub and make a political community, which, you know, it might have to organize around certain hierarchies to be more effective in politics. I do think that the way the right approaches hierarchies is insane, and we shouldn't copy that, and we couldn't by principle. But at least, you know, we should have some sense of political realism.
Yeah, thanks, Balazs. Josefina, what are your thoughts on this? And kind of also, I'd be interested to hear what you think about populism and how the left can or should or shouldn't use that.
Yeah, I was listening very attentively. It's fascinating to hear, especially what's happening in the US, because I think that a lot of the things that happen in our countries kind of, and these new far-right leaders in countries outside of the US or far away from Europe as well, they're really looking into these countries and seeing how they can copy some of the things and, you know, try and see if they work in our countries, in developing countries. A quick reflection that I wanted to add is, and especially because this is what's happening in Argentina at the moment, and maybe it's an example for all of us to look at and reflect on, is what happens when these far-right movements and far-right political parties propose especially a political solution to problems, but especially economic programs that don't work. So when an economic program fails and these parties start to fail, which is kind of what we're seeing here at the moment, is how these movements start pretty quick, surprisingly fast, falling apart. The infight starts. And I think it's what a lot of analysts are saying here as we watch the Milei administration kind of falling into itself because of the result of the negative for them result of the most recent elections, is how it makes me wonder, do some of these newer parties have a future, really? So what happens when the infight starts? And I think on the other side of that, kind of on the, if across the road from that to the more populist government, more left, completely left or more left-leaning political movements, these are movements that have many years of history. So they have had many years of experience of, yes, disagreeing in many things and then agreeing when it's necessary, developing, doing the groundwork, doing the territorial work, at least in many Latin American countries where the more left-leaning political movements have is that they have this connection with people living with the most marginalized people. Right-wing parties rarely have that. They say they do. And yes, there is an argument for, you know, with the pandemic and younger generations, they were kind of disenchanted with traditional politics and then they kind of fell into the arms of the far right. But in truth, what we're seeing when it comes to then voting, which is in the end what matters when people go and decide who do they want to be in power, what we're seeing is that these movements don't really have that connection, that real connection with the people. But in short, I think to me, a big question to ask is kind of what happens with these movements when their economic programs fail, if they have any future. In Argentina, I think that is a big question mark, which kind of gives many of us hope in a way.
So interesting. So we talk about that from a little bit of a different perspective here. What happens when Trump dies? Because he's old as hell. He's not in good shape. Dude clearly just had a stroke. And there's this sort of cult figure aspect to the far right that I think is a lot different from what you're describing. Because we have this figurehead, like literally the Mad King. And he's not going to last forever. What happens when the Mad King falls? The policies that his party are pushing are incredibly unpopular. They're already sending us into a recession, already destroyed so many trade relationships with other countries. Like, what happens when it clearly doesn't work and the Mad King is gone? Can they maintain this sort of momentum? And I'm so curious to find out. I'm not thrilled to have to live through it, but I am very curious nonetheless.
And I think also something that, you know, Balazs and Connor worked on this a bit in the magazine, but to what degree are far-right figures today almost just puppets for a kind of undercurrent of reactionary forces that want to put these figureheads into power so they can keep making money, and they're just going to keep recycling people, and we're going to keep having a return to far-right projects until we kind of dismantle the whole system that puts them there in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, on that, in the UK, we've had a kind of hysteria around flags, which has kind of come from this kind of ideas around immigration and all of this. And it can feel like kind of a scary time. Like, how do you find hope in these kind of times?
I still believe in people. You know, things have been very, very, very bad before. Right? Perhaps it's looked different or manifested itself in different ways, but terrible authoritarian rulers and governments have been a part of this world since someone got the bright idea that we should stop hunting and gathering and start farms. Humanity's made it through all that. I do have faith in the power of people to organize, to look out for their neighbors, to kind of think differently, to think bigger, to even think globally. I mean, things in the States are really dark right now, but I also know so many people who are organizing, whether they're putting together neighborhood ice watches or raising money for Palestinian children or taking their trans friends to the gun range because we got to protect the dolls. Like, there's so many ways that you can make the world a little bit better, even if it's just your block, just your neighborhood, just your city. That matters. That's something. We can't overthrow the government tomorrow. I mean, I have to go to the dentist. I'm busy. But we can make positive changes happen. And we can keep talking to people and trying to educate them. In the States, we have our education system and our media ecosystem. Garbage. But if you're privileged enough and lucky enough to know how to find real news, real information, real history, and can share it with people, that's how people learn, that's how people grow, and that's how people survive these kinds of eras.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think the hope and the answer is for sure on the people. That's our story was all about reporting what people are doing on the streets. The power of social media and the power that this, that the fact that we can connect and we are kind of across the world and we can talk and discuss these issues, but also the power of people taking to the streets and making their voices heard and demanding changes and getting together, forming communities and across issues. I mean, I cover every protest that happens in Buenos Aires, and it's fascinating to see where, in a protest where people are pensioners, you know, 80-year-olds demanding a better pension and at the same time demanding for the end of the genocide in Gaza. And that to me says community, in that ultimately all of this, there is something that we can all do for all of this to pass and for all to show that there is more of us than there is of them.
That was an edited recording of our recent Ask Us Anything panel discussion, featuring New Internationalist co-editor Beth Riley, labor reporter Kim Kelly, human rights reporter Josefina Salomon, and researcher Balazs Turkson. Thanks for listening. If you were inspired by what you heard today and want to support our journalism, please consider subscribing to New Internationalist magazine via the links in our show notes. You can always read more of our in-depth journalism on our website at newint.org. This episode was produced by me, Maxine Betteridge-Mose. I'm the digital editor at New Internationalist. Co-editors of the magazine are Amy Hall, Conrad Landon, Nick Dowson, Bethany Riley, and Decca Muldowney. Our editorial assistant is Paula Lacey. Our theme music has been produced by Samuel Raphael Williams, and our logo design is by Mari Fuz. Audio editing is by Naseek Hamza. Thanks, we'll be back soon.